All right, our next case is 2019-601, the State of Ohio versus Dennis Hackett. For the appellant, we have Mr. Hardwick.
May it please the court, Chief Justice O'Connor, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. While there is no standalone right, quote unquote, right to standby counsel, part of a trial court's job under the Sixth Amendment is to determine the parameters of what standby counsel should look like. And both this court and the United States Supreme Court have so stated that. United States Supreme Court on page 174 of McCaskill said that the counsel clause implies a right in the defendant to conduct his own defense, comma, with assistance. This court in the Syllabus and Martin, interpreting both the Ohio and the U.S. Supreme Court, U.S. Constitution said similarly that the defendant has the right to, quote, conduct his own defense with assistance. This court said that with the assistance of standby counsel. In this case, the trial court was unequivocal on the record and told Mr. Hackett that his standby counsel's only job was to be prepared to step in and become the lawyer should Mr. Hackett change his mind. Nothing more, nothing less.
Counsel, what was the actual prejudice from the lack of standby counsel?
There were a number of problems in this case. First of all, it's important to note that the trial court found that the rape charge was, he said he was, quite candidly struggling with the Rule 29 motion. That was on page 740. Mr. Hackett tried, for instance, to get in a witness who was standing in the, who had been in the courtroom, but didn't actually issue the subpoena, so the person couldn't testify. He had thousands of pages of cell phone records dumped on him just before trial, and he wasn't able to look. He asked for some assistance in looking through them. He didn't even have a computer to look through them. He was unable to do so. Those were the two biggest examples. This case depended on cell phone, in large part, there's a lot of cell phone records. There was DNA evidence, complicated evidence. But I also suggest that generally the rule for when someone is completely denied assistance when they should have received it is that we look at that error as structural because it becomes, in most cases, it becomes difficult to determine what would have happened if that person...
So you say that the Constitution, the United States and Ohio Constitution, gives a criminal defendant the right to have standby counsel?
That is part of what a trial court must decide. It's not absolute. The trial court has discretion to shape the role of standby counsel. But if this court can issue syllabus law, I would say that a trial court cannot arbitrarily limit the role of standby counsel. It's the position of the state and the amicus that it's okay if the trial court is arbitrary, unreasonable, and capricious in the denial. And that is simply not consistent with what the United States Supreme Court has said.
Well, but to go back, so you said, yes, the United States Constitution and the Ohio Constitution do require a trial court to provide standby counsel. That you say that's a constitutional right?
Yes, although it's not absolute in the way that that the right to have your own lawyer is absolute because the McCaskill and Ferretta and Martin do give the trial court discretion in how to shape that. And I think it's important to note that Mr. Hackett's motion for standby counsel is taken almost word for word from McCaskill and Martin. He researched the law.
So if you say, I'm still not sure whether your answer was yes or no to my first question, but you do admit that the trial court has a right to limit or to say how that works, how standby counsel should work, not in an arbitrary way. So really, there is no defined set of rules or regulations or standards for the trial courts to use uniformly. Uniformly, it's just whatever the trial court thinks the defendant needs. And is there any way, secondly, any way for the defendant to know what exactly he or she gets with standby counsel.
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court has given guidance to trial courts and has told trial courts certainly what they can do. And they can do substantially more than what the trial court in this case thought. The U.S. Supreme Court has said that trial court counsel, standby counsel, can go as far as arguing outside, arguing for the defendant outside the presence of the jury, as long as it doesn't, and this Mr. Hackett put it in his motion, as long as it doesn't change the perception or reality that the defendant is in control.
Then how do we review what's enough? How do we review whether one trial court judge permitted standby counsel to do more than another trial court judge permitted? I mean, what's our guidelines? What are our standards?
I'd say that as the case is presented even by the Attorney General show, the standard is abuse of discretion. Is the decision unreasonable, arbitrary, or capricious? And that is a high burden, but here we can meet that in two ways. First of all, the trial court said that it was without authority to give Mr. Hackett what he asked, even though he was basing it expressly on the language of the United States Supreme Court. Certainly part of what he was asking for was, and part of it was even stronger, he just asked for someone to be able to whisper in his ear at counsel table, to consult with a counsel table in a way that still would have left him completely in charge of his case.
Didn't he actually ask for basically co-counsel? And is there any right to have a co-counsel in place?
No, he didn't ask for basically co-counsel because he based on what the U.S. Supreme Court said, and the U.S. Supreme Court said that isn't co-counsel. But even if this court found that several, I think he asked for, say, five things, and three of them were he shouldn't have got, he still asked for one or even the one or two. Just because someone asked for five things, if the trial court determines that three of them are valid, three of them are invalid, and two of them are valid, they still should give them what they are entitled to. And the important thing in this case is throughout this entire litigation, neither the state nor its amicus have been able to show this court any reason why a trial court would want to deny this right, would want to deny counsel to be sitting there at the table. I mean, this prosecutor consulted, the prosecutor interrupted trial, according to the transcript, 16 separate times to go consult with each other. The court reporter noted it. There's no reason why Mr. Hackett could not have done something similar. And if the state can't even give a reason why it's a good idea, now the state, I understand that the state makes non-frivolous arguments when it comes to the technical argument. But when you get underneath those technical arguments, you see a reality that there's no good reason not to do what Mr. Hackett asked for. It's simply arbitrary and reasonable and capricious, and this court should not stand for that.
Counsel, are you saying the major flaw here was that his counsel was not, his standby counsel was not allowed to sit at the table with him? He was in, I guess, the back of the courtroom, correct?
Correct. So in the courtroom, at the back of the
courtroom.
Pardon me? He was in the gallery. I don't know if he's in the back of the gallery.
All right, but he was not able to converse with him unless there was a recess called or some other method.
Well, there's no, first of all, there's nothing in the record to show that the parties ever violated the trial court's order that said nothing more, nothing less. But also on page 22 of the transcript, and I miscited the page in my brief, I said page 33, but it's on page 22 of the voir dire. The trial court expressly said that Mr. DeFabio was in the courtroom, quote unquote. Now, you wouldn't say someone was in the courtroom if they were sitting at counsel table. They also, at all the times you would have expected that Mr. DeFabio's presence be mentioned as him being at counsel table, there was no mention. There was no mention of the jury instructions about him being there. When they introduced everyone to the jury, potential jurors during voir dire, they introduced both prosecutors, the detective at counsel table, and Mr. Hackett. No mention was made of anyone else. And they never mentioned him playing any sort of role other than a mere ministerial role of trying to secure a specific photograph from a specific vantage point that Mr. Hackett.
Mr. Harwick, all that may be true, but I guess I still have, I'm struggling if there's no right to stand by counsel, how any of those things could possibly be a violation of his right to stand by the counsel or the Sixth Amendment or anything else?
Well, it's because what the U.S. and the language of McCaskill is, it does say is the right that the right to the assistance of Sixth Amendment, quote, implies a right of the defendant to conduct his own defense, comma, with assistance. That's McCaskill. So they did say with assistance. Now, I think the state does point to a whole bunch of cases involving ineffective assistance of so-called ineffective assistance of standby counsel. And I'd agree there's no claim there because when he is the ultimate decision maker in his case, he takes responsibility for it's his performance that's deficient in the end. So there is no such thing as ineffective assistance.
So are you saying there is a right to standby counsel, contrary to what almost every circuit has said?
Yes, and even if this court decides the answer that it's not a standalone right, it is part of the analysis that trial courts must go through. The U.S. Supreme Court has mandated court, has said that the next step when someone waives their right to counsel is to decide, well, whether to allow standby counsel. And that's been given to the discretion of the trial court. The standard of review for discretionary decisions is abuse of discretion.
But clearly the court could have said you don't have any right to stand by counsel at all, right? We don't disagree with that.
Well, U.S. Supreme Court could have said that. They haven't said that.
No, but the court in this case could have said you can't have standby counsel at all. You think it's incorrect as a matter of Sixth Amendment law?
I think that would be generally, that would be an abuse of discretion. I can't fathom a situation where that would not be arbitrary and reasonable or capricious. Because again, there's no reason.
Help me with that. I've never seen a generalized abuse of discretion claim. Generally, abuse of discretion is, or always abuse of discretion is tied to some area of the law where the judge is given discretion. I've never seen a standalone claim. So it seems like, well, that's what you're arguing for here.
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court has mandated, and this court in Martin has told trial courts they have to decide the role of standby counsel. That's part of the Feretta process. So it is not. That is where the mandate comes from. It comes from both this court and the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court says conduct his own defense with assistance, and this court says that he has the right to proceed pro se with assistance. That tells me that yes, the trial court must at least think through that. Now, if Mr. Hackett had been disruptive at counsel table, that may have changed things. But there
Counsel, are you saying that if the court's going to allow standby counsel, it has to be a meaningful allowance of standby counsel, and here it was not. I'm trying to understand, based on Justice DeWine's question, what exactly was the abuse of discretion, and how would you characterize it? That yes, the trial court allowed for standby counsel, however, it was a sham. It was meaningless because of the restriction, the way the court fashioned the role of standby counsel.
Yes, in this case, yes, it was meaningless. It was utterly meaningless. It was a sham in this case. It provided no assistance. It was simply his role was to be there ready to jump in. And it was arbitrary because there was no good reason to do it. And also, I guess come back to the trial court thought he could, the trial judge thought he couldn't do this. And that's different from a trial court who thought, here I have this range of decisions from here to here. Where am I going to go in there? This trial court thought that he had no discretion at all. And so he said, no, you can't have any help at all in any way, shape, or form. And that is clearly not the law. Your Honor, at that point, I think at this point I'm going to stop except to reiterate the state has never given any good reason why a trial court would do what this trial court did. This court should reverse and send this back for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, is it Mr. Rivera's going first?
Yes.
Okay.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. Attorney Ralph Rivera on behalf of the state of Ohio and Mahoning County Prosecutor's Office. I will be sharing my time with Attorney Stephen Carney from the Attorney General's Office. This case is plain and simple about the Sixth Amendment right to stand by counsel. The case law is clear that there is no Sixth Amendment right to stand by counsel. And because there is no Sixth Amendment right to stand by counsel, there is no residual right to have standby counsel do any single task, regardless of how minimal it might be. As the Sixth Circuit and Wilson versus Parker discussed, to the extent that standby counsel failed to do any particular task, the defendant merely suffered the consequences of his decision to proceed pro se, similar to an invited error standard.
Counsel, when someone, if standby counsel is deficient in what they're doing, and that's a decision of standby counsel, in other words, they're determining their involvement, or they are involved and it's, you know, a deficient, that's not the same as the court saying, fashioning the role of the standby counsel and merely appointing it and then not allowing for anything further. In other words, it's just waiting to see if it was necessary to step in, I guess, is what the thought was. Do you see the distinction there?
Yes. There's a distinction between that decision to appoint standby counsel, and then once standby counsel is appointed, there is that area of what standby counsel is doing or not doing. In this particular case, the trial court, there's no issue of an abuse of discretion. It was never raised below. It was never dealt with at all with the Seventh District. What the trial court does not have discretion, while they have discretion to maybe appoint standby counsel, Mr. Hackett clearly requested co-counsel. He clearly requested hybrid counsel, and the trial court does not have discretion to allow that. And that is based on the clear language in Martin. Going through Mr. Hackett's motion, he asked for active assistance. He wanted Attorney DeFabio to advocate on the record whenever possible. He wanted, again, to speak on the record to advance his legal and procedural matters.
But wasn't the defendant prohibited from even turning to their standby counsel and just asking a question privately out of earshot of the jury? I mean, isn't that the equivalent of just not having standby counsel at all if you're not allowed to do that?
I just to clarify the record, there is nowhere in this record where the trial court, where Mr. Hackett specifically asked the trial court, can I talk to Mr. DeFabio at any particular time? That question was never asked, and the trial court did make the statement of nothing more, nothing less, to kind of give that impression. But again, it's not on the record, but there was numerous times during this trial where there were conversations, and the record does not reflect one time where Mr. Hackett said, or asked the trial court, can I have a recess to ask Mr. DeFabio a question? The record is clear, and the Seventh District found that there was never any time on the record where the trial court clearly prohibited Mr. Hackett from talking to Mr. DeFabio, and that's really the main argument.
Do you think, counsel, do you think not having standby counsel at the trial table prohibited the communication during the trial?
It did not prohibit the communication during the trial based on, again, it's not in the record, but based on the closeness and proximity from defendant to Mr. DeFabio during the trial.
So what are you saying? How close was he in the courtroom to him?
I would probably say within 10 feet. I think.
Can you say that a defendant could ask an attorney a question if they're 10 feet away?
he could definitely ask the trial court for a recess. And again, I think we're talking about if the
Then the 10 feet matter does not matter at all. He could have been in the back of the courtroom and asked for a recess. So that doesn't matter how close. If he wasn't at the trial table that allowed for a communication, as I think is what he wanted, he probably wanted more. And that was not allowed by the court, of course. But the fact that he was, I guess, shut out of the whole process, basically, by the positioning is troubling.
I think, and just to clarify, Mr. Hackett, again, never once asked for trial counsel to sit at the trial table. There's nowhere in the transcript. The closest that Mr. Hackett comes to asking for that is in his motion. He claims he has, and quote, defendant has the constitutional right to have standby counsel seated at counsel table. I don't think anyone's contesting that there is no constitutional right to actually have him.
Right, eliminate the constitutional basis, but he was asking for trial counsel to sit at his table and the judge denied it.
Well, again, the trial court never specifically denied that request.
Did the trial court rule on that motion?
Yeah, the court did deny the motion based on what the Seventh District also found. The trial court found, the Seventh District agreed, that his motion was for hybrid counsel. That is what
even just sitting at the table at the trial table.
Merely sitting at, I would agree that merely sitting at trial counsel, or I'm sorry, at counsel table, is not hybrid counsel. But again, that is not what Mr. Hackett asked for. Mr. Hackett asked for, his motion is entitled full assistance of standby counsel.
But what does that mean to you?
Well, I mean, to me, the trial court and the Seventh District all found and concluded that Mr. Hackett was requesting hybrid counsel, which is clearly prohibited, which the trial court would not have any.
But again, it full assistance of standby counsel and hybrid counsel. How does a defendant know the difference? And would you concede that the assistance of standby counsel varies from trial court judge to trial court judge?
Yes, I would. Yeah, I would concede that.
Then how would a defendant know what this particular judge would allow in the full range of assistance of standby counsel?
I think the only way you can do it is where you have, as Mr. Hackett did, ask for specific things in his motion. He laid out specific tasks which he was asking for, all of them amounted to hybrid counsel. He was clearly asking for Mr. DeFabio to take an active role in the trial. That's what he wanted, and that's what he was asking for. And that's really the difference. And I think it's one of the main issues in this case. And that is what the trial court denied. The trial court, again, clearly never stated on the record. There's nowhere in the record where the trial court said Mr. DeFabio cannot sit at trial table. And there's not one instance on the record. There's several different pre-trial hearings. There's a discussion before trial. Again, Mr. Hackett never asked for Mr. DeFabio to sit at trial counsel table. And it goes back to what the trial court denied was hybrid counsel. And that was specifically what Mr. Hackett was asking for.
Well, counsel, didn't you just say to me that he put a motion on saying it was his constitutional right to have his counsel at his table?
I'm saying that is the only instance where Mr. Hackett even mentions the word.
Okay, he uses the wrong basis by saying it's my constitutional right, but that was a request to have the attorney at his table.
I guess I would analogize the request as kind of a motion in limine. He asked for the request. He asked for this. He asked for very specific things in the motion. The trial court denied it and explained to Mr. Hackett why the reason he denied it was because he was asking for hybrid counsel. That's all on the record. And he goes, and those are clearly.
But sitting at a table is not the definition of hybrid counsel.
No, no. But he's talking about, the trial court was talking about the specific actions that he was requesting.
And the court could have said, I'm not going to let your standby counsel do any of what you just asked, and still allowed him to sit at the table.
I think if Mr. Hackett would have specifically asked the trial court at the hearing to clarify whether counsel could even sit at trial counsel, I think we'd have that answer, but that never happened. That issue, we have no idea whether, again, we don't know if Mr. Hackett actually wanted that. He put it in his motion, but again, a very vague reference. But again, I would, with my time running out, I would ask this, I would concede the rest of my time to Mr. Carney and ask this court to affirm the Seventh District decision. Thank you.
Mr. Carney.
Good morning, may it please the court. I'd like to supplement the state with two types of points, doctrinal and practical, that show that the Sixth Amendment, by not requiring standby counsel at all, also does not require standby counsel to act in any particular way, and told otherwise would be both unwarranted and unworkable. On doctrine, I want to briefly touch on case law, but mostly focus on the role of prejudice that Justice Fisher asked about. On the no right to standby counsel on the case law, yes, Martin does have some ambiguous language that standing alone might suggest something about standby counsel, but if you look at it in context, and especially at the follow-up case of Obermiller, we see that in Martin itself, the court says two things, that it's permissive, not required, and that the two rights, the right to have counsel or to go it alone with self-representation, cannot be asserted simultaneously. And what Mr. Hackett is doing here is literally asserting both simultaneously. He's saying, I want self-representation, but I also want to still claim basically an ineffectiveness claim by another name. When you say—
Mr. Carney, I asked Mr. Rivera, I think, this question. How does a defendant know where he or she crosses the line with standby counsel and hybrid counsel?
Well, there are two answers to that, Your Honor. First, in this case, if you look at particularly the January hearing, when the trial court first engaged in an extensive colloquy, and he says, you know, you're going to have trouble formulating questions. Attorney DeFabio is going to be there only to step in if you change your mind. And there's a later one, it's either the February or March hearing, where Mr. Hackett asked the trial court, so wait a minute, I can only talk to him if I give up my right. And so he was told,
what that really said was the trial court saying, you represent yourself or you have counsel. Because if you say you'll have trouble forming questions and, you know, your lawyer will only be able to step in if you change your mind, that's not standby counsel. That's either you do it alone or you are represented by counsel.
Well, two things about that. First, the term of art standby counsel really encompasses two notions. One, what the court here did was true standby. Standby to step back in if the self-representation ends. The other form is really advisory counsel, to be advising as you go. And that's what he's asking for. And while that is an option, what he's asking for is to take what McCaskill called the maximum allowed of even offering advice, even doing this and that, and saying that maximum is a minimum. And that's both doctrinally wrong, but it's also where the practicality problem comes in, because it's impractical to say you have to walk this tightrope, both as a court and as the counsel who's appointed, to say, if you go too far and are too active, McCaskill says that violates the right of separate self-representation.
Counsel, but here, did the judge understand that he had more than the model that he used, and he could have had counsel at the table and there just be maybe an exchange of notes or whispers, but not the standby counsel was not addressing the jury, was not questioning witnesses, was not addressing the court.
Well, there are two ways to look at it, and neither way leads to a different outcome here. I see my time's almost up, if I may answer the question. So to the extent the court was saying, I can't do that, I can't do what you're asking, it was in the context of Mr. Hackett over asking for the hybrid co-counsel role. The motion was even titled motion for full assistance. To that extent, the trial court was perfectly correct. He could not go as far as Hackett wanted. To the extent the trial court, if the trial court were hypothetically mistaken about saying, oh, I can't do it, anything, when we concede, of course, Martin does allow it as an option, then it still doesn't create an abuse of discretion here, because one of the elements within that discretion is to say no. So if the trial court were saying, I can't do it, but I'm not giving it to you anyway, I prefer you to do it only this way, that's a perfectly valid choice. And I know my friend on the other side said, oh, the state didn't give a good enough reason. Well, first, he's asserting a right. Frankly, we don't need to give a reason, but also there is a good reason, and that is to not try to make it too easy. It is a valid reason to discourage self-representation. That's why we do a colloquy that says, are you sure you really want to do this? Here are all the problems ahead of you. And one of those is, this is not going to be easy. I want to mention, if I may answer briefly about prejudice, Justice Fischer asked about prejudices here. Prejudice in even a Strickland case, when you have full counsel, you have to show not just this evidence got in or this evidence wasn't admitted. You have to show an ultimate prejudice of a reasonable probability the verdict would be different. And here, with the DNA evidence of the victim's blood on his pants, with the GPS putting his phone in the area of the body, with all of that overwhelming evidence, this was not going to come out the other way. And what he asserts is prejudice of, oh, but look how I formulated questions wrongly. That's basically true in every self-representation case, that they do something that they could have done better with a lawyer. After all, it doesn't say much about our profession if having counsel there would not have improved over what someone did flying solo. And to give him a standard where he doesn't have to show prejudice at all, where he gets an automatic do-over, where everyone else with full counsel, would have to show prejudice, is absurd. It distorts the incentive. So it's both doctrinally wrong and impractical. So
thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, you've used all of your time. You may take 30 seconds. Mr. Hardwick, your mic is off. You're muted. There you go.
Thank you, Your Honor. It is not the job of a trial court to discourage self-representation. It is the trial court's job to inform a defendant of the consequences. And in this case, Mr. Hackett treated the trial court with dignity and respect at all times. He asked for a lawyer to help him sit at counsel table in his motion. It was denied. He asked for clarification of the trial court's ruling. He got it. Nothing more, nothing less. He then proceeded with respect for the trial court's ruling and proceeded with the rest of the trial with dignity and respect. And the trial court's decision in this case not to allow him to have someone just to even whisper to was an abuse of discretion. And I ask this court to reverse and remand.
Well, counsel, if you address the prejudice, the reasonableness that the trial outcome would have been different, given the evidence.
Well, I do say the trial judge who heard the case did say specifically that he thought that the evidence, that it was a close call on the sexual assault charge, especially on the use of force. And then in the state's theory tied in the aggravated murder charge was in the course of fleeing from or conducting the sexual assault. So those two are inextricably linked, and the trial court said there is a difference. But also, the standard usually for a constitutional right is if there was an error, was it harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? And here it was not. And that by itself, this court should reverse. As I said before, I think the better standard is chronic, where this is denied arbitrarily. The usual standard is to allow to consider it structural error and to reverse when a trial court acts so arbitrarily.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.